McMinnville, Oregon. This is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that gets its balls in a twist. I'm Michael Crosser. Of course, you know Chad Tilburg. And today's title is Bernoulli and Magnus Effects. Hey, Chad.
so that's the intro we're going with.
That's what you wanted. And so
Generally,
I cut out most of your bad ideas, but I had nothing else to...
I need to be more sort of discerning about the just jokes that I send you by text and email, because sometimes, they end up in places they shouldn't. So,
yeah,
point taken. So, what are we talking about this week?
Well, we got a very nice email from a listener named Matt.
Mm.
He emailed crisscrossingsci@gmail.com, all one word, all lowercase. Or he could have contacted us on either Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, or...
OnlyFans? No.
Or YouTube.
Oh, YouTube.
We have accounts on all of those. If you want to DM us on all those, that's what the kids say, then we can also answer questions that way. But he sent us a very nice email, and in part it said that he loved our episode 149, about how to hit a home run. It was about baseball.
Baseball.
If you recall, we actually talked about how it's possible to hit a home run even without you physically holding the bat at that exact moment.
Oh, like if you let go of the bat?
Yeah, and so...
That's right. There was a home run that was hit that way that was the genesis of this, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, a Cincinnati ball player, a Red, did that in a game at some point. And if you look at it, like at the moment of actual contact, he had already let go of the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And he still hit a home run from it.
Yeah, I'm remembering this because I remember thinking at the time that having your feet firmly planted onto the ground and being a hold of the bat is somehow how you transferred power from the bat to the ball.
Right.
But I learned that that's not the case.
Yeah, because in the short span of time that you're actually in contact with the ball, the signal of that contact doesn't reach your hands at all at that point. But that led Matt to email us. And he asked us in part how the pitcher is able to alter the path of the ball from his hand to home plate by using various manners of spin added to the ball. And he remembers about reading about the Bernoulli effect and the Magnus effect and how the seams affect the airflow. He asks, any chance you could expound on this topic for your listeners on an upcoming episode of your podcast?
There we go.
And so the answer is no. I'm sorry, Matt.
Anyway, we're talking about something else. Oh, that wasn't nice.
So today we're going to talk all about Bernoulli's effect and the Magnus effect, which is how basically fluids, and today we'll mainly be talking about how air, as the fluid, interacts with things that are moving through it.
What does it mean to be a fluid then?
So not a solid.
Okay. So both liquid and gas.
Would work, yes.
Would work. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And so Bernoulli's principle says that what it does is it mathematically connects how an object moving through a fluid feels a force upon it and why that is. And basically what he found was that the greater the velocity, the reduced pressure on that side of the object.
On that side of the object. Okay. So we have an object, and are we saying that fluid is moving past it?
Well, I think it's useful to think about like an airplane.
Okay.
Wing. Right. So if you've ever really paid attention, I don't know if you've ever really paid attention to an airplane wing, but they generally have like the top side of it is rounded and it kind of comes up a lot more than the bottom side. Like if you imagine the air hitting the middle of the wing, then the air has a lot shorter distance to go if it goes below. I'm thinking of like maybe two streams of air. One slightly above the other. The one that is forced to go up over the wing, because of the shape of the wing being more curved up there, it has a lot farther distance to go to meet up with its partner that it got pushed away from.
That went around the bottom side.
Right.
Okay. And so the one that went up and over, therefore, was moving faster.
Right.
Okay.
According to that. And so in some sense, you would think like, oh, okay, well, according to Bernoulli, then, since it had to travel a lot farther and go faster, that means that it's going to produce less of a pressure on the wing than the bottom side.
Okay.
So that's a lot of words. We don't often think about pressure. We don't often think about this stuff. So I like to think about this in terms of individual atoms kind of hitting you, right?
Mm.
So right now in this room, at the temperature we are, room temperature, every atom on average is going about like 500 miles per hour.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's a simple calculation.
Okay.
Everything's going on average about that. You know, some are going faster, some are going slower, but we're getting bombarded every single second by all these atoms that are just running into us at that speed every single second.
So like atoms of nitrogen gas and carbon dioxide and oxygen.
Yep.
Just pinging around off of us.
Right. And we're used to that. We don't even notice it anymore.
Okay.
But you do notice it if you go like to a higher elevation.
Mm-hmm.
Your ears will pop because at that elevation, then you have fewer of these atoms kind of running into your eardrum, and then it'll pop out.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That makes total sense now that you say that. Of course, I'm aware of as you go up in elevation, there's less pressure,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't quite connected it until just this moment to, therefore, there are fewer molecules banging into you.
Right.
Yeah.
So at sea level, you have a lot more gases banging into you. And then up at a higher elevation, since there's fewer, you're getting hit fewer times. And so then we would say the pressure is reduced.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this is something that I was thinking about on an airplane.
Mm.
You know, they always say that they pressurize the cabin for your comfort.
Uh-huh.
What they're actually doing, so we can't tell the difference between them adding pressure and decreasing the pressure. We just know that our ears pop when that happens.
Uh-huh.
So when you get in an airplane, they actually remove some of the air in the airplane. But comparatively, when you're up high in the air, it's a higher pressure than what would be around there.
Okay.
But it turns out if you try to, you know, if we flew with just the windows open.
Okay.
That change in...
Or a door off.
Well, yes.
Sorry, too soon.
No. Then everyone's would pass out and all sorts of bad things would happen.
Huh.
Because that extreme change of pressure.
Got it. Up to like 30 some odd thousand feet.
Right. Well, the other extreme of that is that if they didn't decrease the pressure at all, they'd have to reinforce the holes a little bit better.
Oh.
Because then there would be too much pressure on the inside of the cabin,
uh-huh.
pushing out, and, you know, a door would fall off, for example.
That's right.
And so what they do is they don't decrease the pressure to that point, to mm-hmm. what it would be at 30,000 feet. They decrease it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So your ears will pop, but it's at a reduced pressure. And then people can be comfortable with that slight change in the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell that they do actually reduce the pressure, because if you open a bottle of water while you're up high, it'll actually squirt out a little bit more.
Mm.
And if you drink the water and put the cap on tight, which I always do whenever I fly,
mm-hmm.
when you land, the bottle will be all crushed up.
Yes.
And so that's always a fun experiment to do.
So you can prove that to yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like carbonated beverages seem a little fizzier.
Yeah, that should be.
There.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that is the relationship between pressure and...
Yeah, so pressure is basically just like atoms running into you and pushing against you all the time.
Uh-huh.
Now, what Bernoulli here is saying is that with the airplane wing, for instance, because they're going faster over the top of it, they are forced to all go sort of the same direction. So they're not pressing, they're not kind of running into the wing so much.
Mm.
So we have an absence of that. That's why the pressure is lower, because they're all forced to go faster, all in the same direction, rather than having a random distribution where some of them are running into the wing. Most of them are going past the wing.
Got it.
In order to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering why that would be the case, but that makes sense. And so that's what, at least in part, creates some of the lift of an airplane wing.
Yeah, that is what causes that. So the air underneath it, though, is still randomly oriented. And so a lot of those atoms are bumping into the wing and pushing the entire airplane up.
Okay.
Same thing happens with cars. The fact that our car, we're sitting in the car, so that if air comes to your car, it has to go up over a lot more than just if it goes underneath your engine there. So cars actually do feel a little bit of lift as well.
Uh-huh.
And that's why, for instance, like race cars, like Indy 500 type cars, they have these airfoils on the back, which are inverted wings.
Uh-huh.
Which are then trying to push the car back down on the ground to give it stability. And
yeah, that makes sense. So that's like what a spoiler is doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like an upside down plane wing to try to pull the car back down. Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
They're more than just like sweet looking things you add to your car.
Right. Okay. There's actually a purpose to them. Yeah.
Okay.
So let's think about this. Like if I just threw a sphere at you, let's not have any spin or anything on there yet.
Okay.
The fact that this ball is thrown right at you, is coming towards you,
mm-hmm.
it's running into a bunch of atoms on its way.
Mm-hmm.
On the backside of it, there are fewer atoms because, I mean, I'm not throwing at 500 miles per hour. My shoulder isn't what it used to be. And so there are still some hitting it on the back, but much reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you throw a ball, then there's, you know, that's what we call drag, is that it's kind of slowing the ball down as it's coming towards you a little bit. So that's Bernoulli's effect happening right there on balls and planes and all sorts of things. So let's add this extra bit here, since Matt was asking us about spin.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's add this effect called the Magnus effect.
Okay.
The Magnus effect describes things when we have rotation involved.
Okay.
Right. And so what you have to do is you have to think about how are the pressures and the forces and the velocities behaving now that I've got rotation, because I don't have just the ball moving.
Mm-hmm.
I have now, if I put some extra spin on it, then part of the ball will be, you can think of it as it's moving faster, and part of the ball will be moving slower.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of different orientations that we're going to have to break down to kind of talk about all the different effects.
Uh-huh.
But they're all leading from the same thing called the Magnus effect.
Okay.
So let's get some of the geometries here. Let's say I'm throwing a ball at you, towards you.
Yep.
And let's say I put a spin, if we're looking from above, let's say that I'm putting a clockwise spin onto it.
Got it. Okay.
So from my perspective then, going away from me, with a clockwise spin on there, that means sort of the left-hand side of the ball is going away from me, and the right-hand side of the ball is spinning, is coming more towards me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The whole ball is going away, but it seems to be going faster on the left-hand side, and the velocity is a little bit slower on the right-hand side.
Got it.
Like if I took at a particular moment in time, the ball on the left-hand side of here is going to see those air molecules are going to run into, you know, the ball itself is running into it, and also the spin is making it seem to be going faster. So it's like really hitting the ball harder on that side, on the left side.
Mm-hmm.
On the right-hand side, it's kind of, you know, they're coming in, but they're kind of like bouncing off in some sense, right? Because it's spinning away from it, they're not hitting it as hard as much. So there's greater pressure in that case on the left-hand side than on the right, which means that the ball itself will tend to curve to the right-hand side.
Wait, hold on. Let me think for a minute. The way you just moved your hand confused me. Curve to the left.
Oh, did I say left?
Wouldn't it
curve to your left. Yeah, and this makes sense to me because I used to play tennis. But like, if I hit it so that I'm putting spin so that it's going clockwise from above.
Oh, I'm thinking counterclockwise. Okay.
Then it will spin to, it'll be your left, but going away from me, it'll be my right. It'll kind of spin off that way.
Okay. And so if there were like a little mark on the equator of the ball as it's spinning,
yep,
as it's coming towards me, for a brief moment, that mark would be moving much faster towards me, but then it would get carried around the rotation of the ball. That mark would get carried around to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And for a brief moment, that mark would slow down.
Yeah.
Because the velocity of the ball itself is still coming towards me, but that side of the ball is moving away from me.
Right.
And so for a brief moment, that mark would be going slower, and then it would come back around to the other side. And for a brief instant, it would be coming faster towards me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the spin, it's the velocity of the ball plus the spin, then it's the velocity of the ball minus the spin.
Right, yeah.
That makes sense.
And so the side that is the plus the spin, it's running into air molecules a lot faster there.
Got it.
So they're bumping into it and pushing it away from them towards the other side. So in this configuration, it would be moving to your left.
Okay.
And so, for example, I used to play tennis, and so I had an advantage because I'm left-handed as well.
Oh.
And so I could serve and put this kind of spin, the clockwise spin, onto the tennis ball. And it would really spin out to the right. And then after it bounced, obviously, it would kick out even more that way.
Mm.
And by the way, Matt also asked if I had any reason why I got into what I do. And mm-hmm. so it's actually because of tennis that I'm a physicist today.
Is it really?
Yeah. And this exact question is why I'm a physicist today. Because my high school physics teacher also played tennis.
Uh-huh.
And she took lessons from my coach. And so he would talk with her and then later in the week talk with me and then so uh-huh. forth. And he knew that I liked math and physics and so forth. And so he would coach her and be like, tell me something cool that I can pass on to Mike when I see him later on.
Oh.
And so then he was always kind of passing that on to me. And so,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Huh.
But so part of it also was about the spin. That like it's now just sort of intuitive to me that if I hit the ball with my left hand sort of on that side, I'm putting a slice and kicking it over to the right like that.
Uh-huh.
Whereas right-handed people hit it from the other side. So when they hit it, the ball is going counterclockwise if you're looking from above.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll kick it off the other direction, the opposite direction that I would do.
Okay. And does the same thing apply to like a golf swing or something? If you the face of the club hits the ball at just a little bit of an angle,
so
it puts a spin on the ball?
That's what they call a slice and a
hook.
And a hook.
Okay.
Exactly the same thing. If you don't have a perfectly straight swing, if as you're coming through, if you accidentally kind of either come in a little bit while you make contact or away while you're making contact, then you'll put additional spin onto the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you have to yell four and warn people on okay. the next hole that you're uh-huh. going to run into them. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can have the clockwise, the counterclockwise. We can also put on what's called top spin.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be, so from my perspective, I throw the ball towards you, but I have it spinning on the axis so that the side that's towards me is going up. The side mm-hmm. facing you is going down.
Mm-hmm. So it's like as if the ball were also tumbling towards you, towards the target.
Mm-hmm. And what that will do, if you think about the forces involved here, is it's the same sort of thing. It's going to feel a force pushing it more downward.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is very common in tennis as well, that you hit with a lot of topspin.
Yeah.
And so to make that happen, you're swinging your arm up really fast,
mm-hmm.
which tends to make it pop up. But then the Magnus force is making it pull it back down, so it still lands in the court. So the topspin then is very common in tennis. It's also very effective in volleyball. Sometimes they'll, on the serve, they'll do that to, it'll kind of pop up and then fall down really fast, and people have to deal with it that way.
I used to play, I don't think I played as much tennis as you did, but I played some tennis in like middle school and high school. And when I finally figured out how to do the topspin thing, that was so fun.
Yeah.
Just to see the ball shoof, just dive right over the net and then go kicking out.
And you can hit it so much harder because it'll make it
really wail
down
on it, and you're not like sending it out of the, out of the courts.
Yeah.
Huh, cool. Okay.
And then one more that we can talk about right now will be the backspin. And so this is, if I'm throwing a ball towards you, the backspin would cause it to, the bottom side would be going faster away, and the top side would be coming towards me more. So that axis of rotation there.
So it's like the opposite of the topspin.
Yeah, and so the backspin will tend to just, now we have a force that tends to make things kind of pop up more. And so, you know, this is a great thing, like in baseball, if people hit it and put that kind of spin when they make contact, then that will help kind of lift it up and hit a home run, basically.
So if you get under the ball a little bit.
Just a little bit, not too much.
There's a bit, okay.
Or in tennis, they can do a backspin to do drop shots and that sort of thing. So I should note that all of these effects are dictated by the speed of the ball in general. Like if things are going faster, then you're going to see more of an effect.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Because you have just more atoms that are bumping into it. So they'll be acting, it'll be a stronger effect basically.
Okay. And so this is why you don't really see these kinds of things visibly until you get to like real professional athletes doing it. Cause like a middle schooler or even a high schooler probably isn't going to be throwing hard enough to.
Yeah. They can't throw a baseball 100 miles per hour or anything like that. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So the faster you can throw the ball, the more of these effects can take place.
Okay.
And it also depends on the mass of the ball as well. You know, a heavier ball just will not get pushed around as easily as a lighter ball.
Is that right? Okay. You know what? I feel like I've also seen like in softball pitches have some pretty wicked English on those softballs. And even though it's a larger ball, is it a little bit lighter than a baseball?
I believe so, yeah.
And so the fact that they're whipping that thing really fast and it's a little bit lighter, plus it is the larger surface area of a softball, does that give it more opportunity to interact with the air molecules?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's kind of helps us understand how things like a curveball works, right? And so if the pitcher puts a certain amount of sideways or topspin on it, it's going to kind of carry the ball in a, if it's a right-hander, sort of like in a upper right to lower left sort of direction, and a left-hand pitcher, it'll carry it in an upper left to lower right kind of direction.
And I should note also, if you watch baseball on TV, the position of the camera is always is weird.
Oh, like when you're watching from behind the pitcher's shoulder, like way from far away?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that gives a weird perspective. So it looks like the ball is going just crazy spin and stuff like that.
But it really does.
But that's partly because of just where the camera is and your angle to see it all.
Okay.
It's not breaking that much. But it is it's breaking, but it's not, you know.
Well, I wondered about that because I feel like, so that's a really common angle to like watch a game on TV or something. But then occasionally when they show you the view from the side and like the pitcher's on the left side and the batter and catcher are on the right side and then they show the pitch, it doesn't look like the trajectory of the ball changes nearly as much from that perspective. And, and so I've always wondered what's up with that. So it has at least something to do with the angle of observation.
There's some part, some piece of that,
All right. Okay, so I think I have a handle on how curveballs work, at least like the spin you would need on it in addition to a pretty high velocity.
And all four of those are doing, it's the same science.
Okay.
It's just the direction of your rotation, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, you could imagine some other angle of rotation similar to those. We talked about four extreme cases, but you could see, you know, at 45 degrees or something like that, and that it would spin in that particular direction as well.
So then would a rising fastball, would that have like backspin on it?
Mm-hmm.
So that it sort of keeps just a little bit more of its height in its trajectory? So what about a knuckleball then? What's going on with that?
So a knuckleball is ideally... With a knuckleball, like you hold it differently, and you're trying not to put any spin on it whatsoever.
Okay.
All right. So putting spin on it will make it curve in a, intentionally make it curve in a certain way. A knuckleball is intended to not have any spin whatsoever.
I feel like I've seen replays or something of a baseball game where there's like a knuckleball pitcher and they'll just show you like a slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks weird.
Yeah.
Like a really good knuckleball.
Yeah.
Just to see it, the ball floating without any spin on it.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So what's that doing sort of in this like ball traveling through the air at a velocity interacting with air molecules kind of way?
Well, in that case, then we have to recognize that a baseball is not a perfect sphere,
mm-hmm.
like a smooth sphere.
Right.
Neither is a soccer ball or a volleyball. They all have seams on them. And mm-hmm. so there's these little channels where air can move and do different things. But specifically for a baseball, then the seams actually stick out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we just talked about Bernoulli's equation here that if you force the air to move at a larger, more of a distance,
mm-hmm.
then that's effectively pulling up at that one spot.
Okay.
So you can imagine if I threw a baseball with the seams, if I catch the seam just right, then it might cause the ball to lift up towards that seam.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's also going to do a little bit, because we have no intentional spin on there, that's also going to maybe push the ball a little bit to maybe rotate it just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So that maybe a different seam will be interacting with the air more.
Right, and then it pulls it in that direction.
And it pulls it in that direction. And so then it, as it's going along, the seams are kind of just randomly interacting with the air.
Yeah.
And so it makes it seem like it's jumping around and
yeah,
skittering around like that.
Huh, okay. And so the Magnus effect is not really happening for a knuckleball.
Right.
This is just Bernoulli
yep.
effect.
Yep.
Okay.
Because there are these seams standing up for that.
Okay.
I will say in college baseball recently, they changed the seams to be not as pronounced.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah. I think they're trying to stop it from hitting as many home runs and
oh, really?
Like I think so.
Yeah. Do they still use aluminum bats in college baseball?
I believe so. Yeah.
Is that involved with why there are so many home runs?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. But and you can also see it like if you kick a soccer ball pretty flat, it'll also seem to jump around.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen YouTube videos of that happening. The ball itself doesn't look like the spots on the ball are moving, but its path and the goalie is like,
Yeah, and volleyball, the same thing happens.
Uh-huh.
When I've played it, I've witnessed that before where you're like, oh, the air caught it, but it's also just as it's going through the air. Volleyball is very light. So So there's one other direction of rotation that we could talk about, though.
Ah, okay, yeah.
What's so up? So we've talked about top spin where the top side is going towards you and
uh-huh.
bottom side is towards me, backspin, slice and hook and all that. Mm-hmm. We could also have a spin where my object is coming towards you, but maybe from my perspective, it's rotating around a clock face.
Mm.
So like if I were looking at it from above, I would see everything moving to the right.
Mm.
From below, it would be moving to the left. But from my perspective of throwing it, it's spinning around like a clock.
I see. This would be the case where the axis of rotation is basically pointing at me as well as at you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that actually comes up a lot with shooting and target practice and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And it's actually kind of an interesting detail here that have you heard of the differences between muskets and rifles?
I have a general understanding of what they are and
mm-hmm.
but not pertaining to what I think we're talking about here.
Well, it's kind of interesting. So like muskets were sort of the first generation of gunpowder fueled, small handheld weapons.
Uh-huh.
Cannons are bigger than,
Sure.
And it's basically just you stuff a bunch of gunpowder in the back and then you put this lead ball. It starts out as a nice sphere.
Uh-huh.
And you tamp that down in there and then somehow you ignite it and that uh-huh. explosion shoots this ball out.
And it's just a hollow pipe
mm-hmm.
that we're okay.
Yeah. It's just a hollow pipe. Nominally isn't affecting it, but there's imperfections in there. So
okay.
it's going to come out kind of randomly, maybe with a little bit of rotation, but not too much.
And so as that ball travels down that pipe, is it just kind of like banging mm-hmm. along the surfaces?
Yeah.
And is each of those little times that it bangs along the inside of the pipe, is that perhaps putting a little bit of spin on it?
It might.
Okay.
It might. But probably the bigger thing is that the fact that you've got this explosion at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And this is, remember, it's a lead ball, which is really soft.
Uh-huh. Oh.
You actually deform the backside of it.
Oh, I see.
And so if you do get it to rotate at all, Now this is like an extreme knuckleball.
I see. Okay.
You know, because you got this huge deformation, and if that does kind of come out around to the side a little bit, it's going to push the bullet a lot, going all over the place.
So that seems like muskets would be really inaccurate.
Yes.
Okay.
Whereas rifles, what they did was they took the bore, the channel where the bullet came through, and they intentionally cut a spiral groove all along there, so that they're intentionally putting a rotation on it to make it do what I described of, as it's going away from you, you got a clock face spiraling in that direction.
Okay. And so in addition to that, the bullets are also not spherical lead balls, right? They're
not anymore. No.
Not anymore. But so originally, were they?
I believe they were, yeah. Pretty similar to that, yeah.
And so the main difference about the thing coming out wasn't so much a bullet-shaped bullet versus a musket ball.
Mm-hmm.
It was, in one case, they were actually rotating in this. Mm-hmm. What would we call that direction? What direction would we call that? There must be some name for that kind of rotation, right?
Yeah, perpendicular to its direction of, well, or you said the axis of rotation is aligned with the direction it's flying.
There you go, yeah. And so that's the direction that the bullet fired down a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Is actually spinning in that way. Now, what's important here is that Magnus effect doesn't play a role in here. Before we were talking about, you know, the left side is moving towards you and the right side is moving away. And so then it would get, you know, it would see different things that way. But with this spinning in the way it is, it's not doing any of that. It's just the spinning doesn't affect that piece of the situation at all.
Okay. So if we had, again, like a dot on the ball at the equator of its rotation, that dot would be going through the air at the same velocity, regardless of where it was in its cycle around the axis.
Mm-hmm. And so the Magnus effect does not play a role here.
Okay.
And so to first order, you'd say, well, then it doesn't have any effect whatsoever. But in reality, what it does do is that if there are defects on the bullet, like with the musket, then that would get pushing it all over the place.
Extreme knuckleball, like you said, okay.
But here, if it's rotating in this way, it's sort of averaging out that whole disruption.
Okay.
And so it made rifles much more accurate than muskets were.
Huh, cool.
And so you could accurately aim at something, you know, 100 yards away or so and hit what you wanted to hit.
Uh-huh.
Whereas with muskets, it's just like, we'll just fire a bunch of these out there, you know?
If you fire enough of them.
Yeah. And it's actually kind of, this is a complete aside, but it's kind of interesting to think about the American Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
Because the British were here, their armies were, they all had muskets.
Mm-hmm.
And their intent was, you know, they line up on this side of the field, you line up on your side of the field, and we come in at each other and we shoot muskets at each other. And 100 people shooting, we're going to hit something, as you said.
Uh-huh.
And then they do the same thing and they're going to hit something. And then you take a few steps forward and then you do the same thing. And then eventually you get hand-to-hand combat, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But then the Americans, they all had rifles because they were hunting for their own food. And so they weren't unlike an army where they were handed the weaponry. They brought their own guns, right? So they brought their rifles with them. And they were able to actually hit their targets and fight in that way. And so it's actually interesting. There are some people who think that that played a major role in the Revolutionary War.
Interesting. The Bernoulli effect physics of how the projectiles traveled based on what the spin was like on the bullet.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. And here we are.
And here we are.
And here we are.
Thank you, Bernoulli.
Thanks, Bernoulli.
Yeah, so that's how a spin can affect projectile motion.
Okay.
So Matt, thank you for writing us. Again, he wrote us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com, all one word, all lowercase. Oh, actually, so I said here a reason why I became a physicist. What led you to biology?
Not become a physicist?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was part of his letter too, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What led me to becoming a biologist? I would say that having a childhood of ample opportunity to have unstructured playtime outside and just getting dirty and watching insects do their thing was what did it for me.
Hmm. And so it was actually you were watching insects and not like birds and...
Yeah, I was always... There was this very large anthill at my grandparents' farm. Came to understand years later that it was a harvester ant mound, and it was there for years and years and years. And every time we went and visited my grandparents' farm, which was fairly frequent, that's one of the first places I would go, was out to this large ant mound and sort of poke around. It wasn't like in any sort of systematic hypothesis testing kind of way. It was more like, you know, maybe a stick or firecrackers or something. But I was still fascinated by the behavior of all these little individuals. They're seeming complete indifference to me when I was just there watching, but then their total alert alarm and aggressive behavior in defense of their nest when I started messing with them.
Did you ever, because I used to watch an ant trail, mm-hmm. and then I would like lick my finger and like mess up their trail,
yeah,
you know, to make them all walk and then be like, oh, I'm going to veer off in this direction for some reason.
Yeah, I still love doing that.
Well, anyway, thank you, Matt, for writing in, and hope we answered your questions.
Thanks, Matt.
This episode was recorded on the beautiful campus of Linfield University. Rudy Ortega wrote our theme music. If you have questions that you'd like us to answer, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com, all one word, all lowercase, or hit us up on any social media. Until next time, thanks for listening.